In a world where dialogue often seems polarized and closed off to diverse viewpoints, the Kraken Backs podcast stands as a beacon of open conversation and enlightening discourse. In our latest episode, we delve deep into the contentious realm of evidence-based medicine with a true pioneer in the field of sports chiropractic care, Dr. Stephen Pearl. Join us as Dr. Pearl, who boldly stepped into the limelight during a transformative era for chiropractors in 1991, shares his groundbreaking journey and provides a keen insight into the shifting paradigms of healthcare. From the perspective, reflections on the legacy of intuition-based medicine, to his views of what true evidence-based medicine should be all about, tune in for an episode brimming with critical reflections, differences of opinions, and thought-provoking perspectives where history meets foresight, only on the Kraken Backs podcast.
Oh boy, we're in for a big one today. Dr. Stephen Pearl, I've only known for what, 40 years now?
I'm sure it's not Stephen.
And or Steve. Hey, Steve.
Any of those. Yeah. Hey, I'll respond to anything if there's food attached to it. So that works better.
How about Dr. Pearl? Dr. Pearl.
Yeah. Yeah, Stephen's good. Yeah, you know, as my father-in-law said, you know, he's on a seafood diet. He sees food and eat it. And, you know, that's been my thing too.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you, I've known you for so long. And then when I proposed having a brilliant guy into sports injuries as a doctor that has achieved milestones for chiropractic.
He wasn't available, so he went to you.
Yeah. I was waiting for that. Terry, I was waiting for that. I knew that. I thought Spencer was going to say that instead of you.
I really wasn't intending on saying that. But since you brought it up, we did have David Seaman on already, so you were second best. So no.
Yeah. And Jan Corwin.
Well, you do know that David sublet from me.
Yes, I do. I do. He was your secondary, your peasant involved in the.
Well, you know, it was separate practices. That was the funny thing, is of course, is that, you know, I don't know if you've experienced this, two chiropractors practicing together, and you want to get adjusted, and you got to go make an appointment with somebody else because you're in the same office. You're never going to see each other.
Yes, we know that well. So, oh gosh, no, it's really great to have you on. And I actually did not know that Dr. Terry knew you before. Our sports injury stuff has brought us together, you know, over history. And it's, he had nothing.
Yeah, it's a long history.
Yeah. He had nothing but nice things to say, or nothing to say at all. No, I'm kidding.
Well, if he said something nice, then that probably meant I paid him.
Oh, well, let me ask you, because I never spoke to you about what you did back in 1991, and I'm keeping it clean now. I'm talking about the, you know, Mobile USA Outdoor Track and Field Championships, and, you know, I want to kick this right from the start and really shed some light on what you've done in track and field, and how the heck did you end up as medical director?
Yeah, that's, you know, it's a funny thing is, I don't know if you know that ACA at one point in time did this thing called, it was like ACA Connects or something with colleges where they could get a speaker to come in about anything. And so, you know, I did it's the only time I've done this, is I did a presentation for National on how to build a sports chiropractic practice. And one of, you know, probably should have like looked at the PowerPoint to remember what the things were, but you know, one was like, you know, keep your eye on the prize. That's always one. And you know, and the other one I said was that often opportunity knocks and nobody answers. And so what happened was, you know, I started practicing in New York City, and I'm going to say when I left TCC, I sort of was like Joe Holistic chiropractor, you know, That was how I practiced. Although I'd been an athletic trainer all through high school and college. I mean, I'm not sure of the statute of limitations, but I started practicing in the state of New Jersey at age 14 as an athletic trainer. You know, I had, the head football coach was my history teacher. And at the end of football season, my freshman year, this guy talked a little weird and he goes, anybody out there want to be a doctor? And I raised my hand and he says, how would you like to be a twainer? And I said, a twainer? And he said, oh, don't be a wise ass kid. It's like being a team doctor and you get a varsity letter. And he got me the Kramer, you know, like everybody in sports medicine knows Kramer right. products.
So
got me the Kramer student trainer honed study kit. In March, I'm in, you know, I got him for history. I'm in history class one day and he says, Steve, twack. He's the only one who called me Steve. Steve, twack practice starts tomorrow. And why don't you come out and be the twainer for twack so you know what you're doing before the football season starts.
Wait, who the fuck was this guy, Elmer Fudd?
You know, he was Mr. Stroud was an interesting guy. And so, you know, I like read the whole Kramer book that night, you know, like, oh my God, come to the, field house where the track team and football team, were set up. And, here's the trainer's room. And one of the coaches says, if you get injured, that's the training room. That's the trainer, Doc Pearl. You go see him. And so from the time I was a freshman in high school, it was Doc Pearl. And actually my senior year in high school, I had a freshman of the football team who, had first it was heat cramps and then it was definitely heat stroke. He lost almost 30 pounds in water weight in the one day.
Oh my God.
And, yeah, so that's the first life I can say I actually saved. And so lived outside of New Jersey at that time, and the Bergen Record, which was the Bergen County, just the part of New Jersey, just west of New York City. Bergen Record was interviewing high school athletic trainers, and you know, they asked you what was the hairiest thing that happened to you, and I said, well, I had a kid almost die. And so the story, you know, my picture was the picture for the story.
Wow.
And, you know, and then I went to Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute. And as a freshman, I was the only freshman who they put with a team as a solo, because I'd already been operating independently as an athletic trainer for 3 years. I trained two more people at my high school. Since I was Doc Pearl. Now, let's see if you can figure this out. Since I was Doc Pearl, the first guy I trained, what do you think his nickname was? Nurse! Nurse!
No.
Yeah. Yeah, he was...
No.
He was a year ahead of me, so I'm a sophomore, and he's a junior, and everybody calls me Doc, and they call him Nurse.
That's classic. Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Did they have concussions then?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Hey, well, did you see on Facebook about mine?
No. What happened?
Oh, so, you know, like I'm like all senior citizens. I play pickleball. Oh. And and I was backpedaling. I tripped and landed my back completely flat, but my, you know, the back of my head against the concrete wall. And I got my bell rung. And so I, the first, you know, when things are okay, I first posted something to my graduating class Facebook page saying, you know, a bunch of you guys, I've managed your concussion. And you know, when I started working with long distance runners, I started training with them, and I've never run a race, but you know, I used to run every day, and my patients whose team I trained with, you know, I'd go do hill work and speed, you know, we do hill work and speed work in Central Park. And they'd say to me, Doc, why are you doing this? And I said, oh, so I can get the same injuries you have. So in the thing I wrote about having the concussion, I said, well, you know, it's taken me, you know, like over 50 years, but now I finally know what it's like to get your bell rung.
Wow. And he didn't pickleball. Yeah. Not like, you know, rugby or football. He didn't pickleball.
Yeah. Yeah, just fell backwards. Injuries. And the crazy thing is that, you know, the place we play, it's Senior Center. They have padding on the wall. No, seriously. You know, it's this, I play in a, it's pickup games in Senior Center, and they have padding on the wall, but the padding doesn't go to the bottom 6 inches.
Oh, no. And you found the bottom six inches.
And I'm playing pickleball after this show, but doesn't have padding on the walls.
Yeah. Well, you play indoors or outdoors?
I'm playing outdoors.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I play outdoors also, but this league is indoors. Oh. But yeah, so.
So the padding on the walls prepares you for the insane asylum.
I mean, have you ever had your bell rung?
Not like playing this? Pickleball, no.
Or anything. No. Well, okay. Yeah. Yeah. So it was rugby. I mean, but have you, you know, because it takes leather balls to play rugby. But did either of you guys ever get a concussion?
I have. Yeah. I've had a couple. That's why I'm the way I am.
Yeah.
I wish I had one so I had an excuse.
Yeah, well, that's why the way I am now. Yeah. But I mean, don't you as a doctor experience injuries differently?
Oh, yeah.
You know, because you have this like analytical viewpoint of it while you're still suffering from it.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
And so, you know, the concussion was interesting. I mean, you know, I couldn't walk. You know, it was unstable. I had, like in the right lower quadrant of my visual field, it looked like I was looking through wavy water.
Oh, God.
You know, and, you know, like the, I had like sort of a headache that just sort of felt like pressure for about 24 hours. Mm. You know, and, you know, I mean, you know, I didn't lose, you know, I was completely conscious. I didn't lose, you know, place, position, time, any location, any of those kinds of things, date, all of that I still had, but.
So let me ask you, if you post-concussion, do you still remember how you became the medical director for USA Outdoor Track and Field?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it was a choice whether you were going to cycle back there or me, because you know me, I don't go. You know, I have ADHD, obviously, but they that was not something they ever diagnosed back then. So, you know, the thing is, when I came to practice in New York, it was like Mr. Joe, holistic chiropractor. And actually I had an uncle by marriage who was suggesting how I could, build a practice. He was a dermatologist. And Keith Richards was one of his patients, which I don't think is a ringing endorsement for a dermatologist when you see his face, but that's okay. And he had suggested, you know, oh, in Central Park, they have races every weekend. He said, why don't you get like a shirt that has like the chiropractic caduceus, go to the park and just, give out information. And one key thing was do not bring a business card. Hmm. He said, if you bring a business card, it says you need business. And then, my aunt and this guy divorced and he's dead, but, normally I wouldn't tell people's names, but his last name was Curtin, Kurtin. And this is something he told me, which is like a valuable thing from a practice standpoint, is he said he noticed patients sign checks, Curtin. Instead of K. And so he contacted the phone company. That's when people used, you know, the yellow pages. And that's when they called 911. And he made sure there was a listing for Dr. Curtin with a C as well as Dr. Curtin with a K. And it resonated a lot with me because when he told me this, I had had a patient who came to see me who said his sister saw me, you know, a couple days before, and I said, you know, what's her name? And he's, she's got the same last name as me. And I said, well, you know, I have a horrible memory for names. I mean, like, you know, one day I'm looking at the list of the patients for the next day, and I asked my receptionist, who's this? And she says, that's your sister. And I only have one sibling, you know? So, and it turns out that she went to see Stephen Pearl, spelled not P-E-A, not P-E-R-L-E, like I spell my name, but P-E-A-R-L, who's an orthopedic surgeon.
Oh, no.
And so, you know, I called back then Ma Bell. I called him up and I got Stephen with a V, Stephen with a P-H. I got Pearl, P-E-A-R-L. I got Pearl, P-E-A-R-L-E, because sometimes people remember there's an E on the end. And then I, of course, had the listing with the way it was properly spelled. So I go to Central Park. I find that there's a whole medical group there. I walk up to who looks like they're in charge, and I said, you know, hi, my name's Stephen Pearl. I'm a chiropractor. Been an athletic trainer for 7 years. Do you guys need help? And they were like, hell yeah, we always need help. And so this is another part of like building the practice. It was consistency. So I went to races in Central Park come hell or freaking high water. If it was, you know, 110 degrees and they were stupid enough to have a race, I'd be at the race. If it was, you know, 32 degrees and raining, I was at the race. If it was 20 degrees and snowing, I was at the race. And then, you know, what happened was I was looking to buy, I don't know if you ever heard of the Myomatic.
Yeah, I remember that.
Or the sort of precursor was the electroacuscope.
Mm-hmm.
And I was going to buy it, and I haven't pulled the plug on it yet. And the local distributor, he gets me in touch with Jack Scott. Is that name familiar to you at all?
No.
So Scott was a sports psychologist, and if he was well known, he was well known. And I'm going to say this is sort of like my uncle with Keith Richards, who was well known as the sports psychologist working with Bill Walton. So, you know, I don't know that that's a ringing endorsement either, kind of thing.
Sure.
And he was the national distributor, and he was coming to New York. You know, we talked on the phone, and he really wanted one in New York City, because at the time, the Mobile Indoor Track and Field Championships, the Milrose Games, New York was the heart for indoor track and field. And so he undercut the local distributor, sold it to me. And to placate the guy, he came to do a sales talk. And he calls me up the night before. And this is an example of opportunity knocking, but sometimes people don't answer. So he calls me up the night before and he says, the number one track coach in America and the number one American marathoner are coming to my hotel room for me to treat him. Why don't you come by instead of waiting the next morning for that sales talk, you know, where he was going to talk about how to use the Myomatic. And my wife and my dad and I were painting my office. I was moving spaces. And we were actually doing the painting. My dad and I did the build out. And, I abandoned my wife and my dad to go to this guy's hotel room. I said, why don't I bring my own stuff? And the coach involved, his wife was there. He said, you know, my wife can't run up a flight of stairs without her leg going numb. She's seen everybody. This guy, I don't know if I should leave his name out or not, but I don't think he would care. Tracy Sundlin. I don't know if you know Tracy's name.
Sounds familiar.
Tracy was the youngest Olympic track coach ever, not for the Osos, for Puerto Rico. And, Tracy is why, people know Leroy Perry's name. He's the one who got Leroy into the Olympics and got all these people. And so, I adjusted his wife, and, Tracy was on the far side of the hotel room, and it was one of the loudest cracks you ever heard. And I mean, this was like, did I break something? I know it was long axis distraction of the hip joint. And he says, what the hell was that? I said, I just adjusted her. And I said, well, let's see what it's like. And she ran up like 10 flights of stairs that was in the Helmsley Palace, ran back down and, said, no numbness. And he turns to me and he says, I'm going to make you rich.
Wow.
And the guy selling the equipment says, he's not lying. I didn't know who Tracy was at the time. He says, he's not lying. He's the one who made Leroy Perry famous.
Wow.
And so everything in long distance road racing, track and field, cross country that I did in New York, all of that was that opportunity knocking and, yeah. And me abandoning my wife and dad while we're painting to go, go there.
Where's,
and I think part of that is seeing, you know, is keeping your eye on the prize.
Yeah.
And actually what had happened was, I mean, there's another part of it is that I had, when I moved offices, my practice had, I bought the practice. My practice had dropped precipitously, mostly because the guy I bought it from saw everybody three times a week come hell or high water. And I pretty quickly dropped off 2/3 of the value of the practice because I just wasn't going to do that and didn't know what I was going to do. And I went with this practice management company and, you know, the idea having a goal card. Right. Mm-hmm. You know, I'd learned that before. And so I came back from meeting with them and I wouldn't do what they wanted. They wanted me to take out full page ads in the New York Times to get patients. You know, I mean, they wanted me to do illegal stuff, you know, no out of pocket expenses, you know, commit insurance fraud. And I didn't do any of that, but I hired an artist to design a logo. And my business card was my goal card. My business card said the athlete's chiropractor. And you had to read it correctly because it's the athlete's chiropractor.
Oh, the athlete. Right, right. Where is it now? Where, like who did, as far as, USA track and field, did other chiropractors get involved? You bring in other ones that, you know, to network and,
you know that, I mean, that's a really funny thing. It's about that opportunity knocking thing. Mm-hmm. So before the track and field championships, and I knew I was going to be medical director 2 years earlier, it was 2 years in planning, and you had, John Scringon. John was the assistant medical director. Mm-hmm. You know, all the senior staff were chiropractors. There were four of us who ran the whole thing. We spent 2 years planning it. So when I sold my practice in 91, I also was the chairman of the sports medicine committee for the Metropolitan Athletics Congress, which put on all track and field and cross country. Long distance racing was done by New York Roadrunners Club. So I supplied doctors for, you know, 250 events. Scringe was one of them. That's how he, you know, one of his classmates I bumped into who was an athletic trainer. He gave me the name of John and a bunch of his classmates and they became other people who took the load off of me because I was doing all those events before. And so, you know, I was trying to give that position away and all the chiropractors I contacted. You know, I can make you in charge of all track and field and cross country racing in the New York metropolitan area. I don't want to do it.
Wow.
And so when Seaman and I practiced together, there was an MD who practiced with me also, Sublett too, and he ended up taking it over.
The MD. Wow. Wow. Let me ask you, because I'm also interested in you. Also were a professor that you've since retired. You taught a lot about evidence-based medicine.
Yep.
You know, I want to ask you about that because evidence-based medicine is under fire. You know, the way the way science has been manipulated, you know, based on what we've seen with the pandemic, what does evidence-based medicine mean to you? And how do you feel about where it's at this point in life?
Well, I think I don't know if you knew this. I wrote an ethics column for Dynamic Chiropractic and ACA News. Between the two of them, I wrote 150 different articles. And I talked about, so the American Chiropractic Association was going to develop a new code of ethics. And Steve Baker from Arizona and I were on a ACA committee. We wrote the code of ethics. And I come to Washington for the ACA House of Delegates meeting. And my good friend Keith Overland, who's, you know, like 15 minutes away from here, Keith catches me as I walk in the door and he says to me, "We are going to have a floor fight, you and I." And I said, "Why?" And it was because in the preamble, I think we said that the doctors of chiropractic should practice using principles of evidence-based practice and best practices. And Keith says to me, "Nobody likes the evidence-based practice. They hate that. That's what they think insurance companies are using as, I'll say, a cudgel to beat them over the head and not pay them." And I said, "Are you keeping best practices in?" He said, "Yeah." I said, "Okay, we're cool."
Well,
it means the same damn thing.
In 1993, evidence-based medicine was first introduced and it failed. And that's part of the reason why.
That's not true.
Then what is?
That's not actually the dates. It's older than that. You can go back and look at, Dave Sackett's book, but it actually goes back to, Gordon Guyette and Dave Sackett and a whole bunch of other people. It started at McMaster University is where they started first using the terminology.
When was that? Because it appeared in publication in 1993.
I'd have to look it up.
Okay. All right.
You know, you'll see it's older than that and it didn't fail. It was quite successful. You know, I got a FCER grant and I was at a conference put on by, doesn't exist anymore, the Agency for Healthcare Policy and Research, which the orthopedic surgeons got rid of after they said that spinal manipulation was good for acute low back pain. And I was at the conference and the dean of NYU School of Medicine was talking about the penetration of evidence-based practice throughout the medical school. And he said the problem was, if you had one faculty member who said, "Oh, I think it's BS," then students would gravitate to them and they wouldn't buy into it.
Mm.
But you know, the people call it the three-legged stool, which is best available external evidence, doctor's expertise, and patient's values. I hear so often in social media that when chiropractors talk about this, they mischaracterize the doctor expertise part of it. And they'll say, "Well, you know, I've been doing the Fluffernutter technique I was taught at good old Fluffernutter Chiropractic College, for 40 years. That's my expertise. That therefore it's evidence-based." And that's not, because if that was evidence-based, then what do we need the evidence for? We're just going to do the Fluffernutter technique.
Mm-hmm.
And evidence-based from the doctor expertise standpoint, I'm going to say sort of fits in two ways. One is, And I used to talk about this all the time with my students. So you guys know, somebody with a really bad disc walks in your office and you look at him and you go, "Disc." Right? You've seen enough patients. You walk in, you say, "That's a disc." Now, you don't write that down as the diagnosis, but in your diagnostic pathway and what questions you're going to ask and what tests you're going to do, you're going to start with the ones related to disc. And if you start asking questions that don't sound like disc, then, you know, number two or number three in your differential diagnosis is going to pop up a little bit higher, but you're still going to do the testing to either rule it in or rule it out. And the same with number two and number three. When a chiropractic student who's got no experience sees that same patient, they go, "Oh, holy crap. And then they have a whole list of what they think it is. And then when they, you see their questioning is like bonkers. It's coming from all over the place. It's not, you know, does the pain down your leg, does it get worse when you cough, when you sneeze, when you defecate? You know, like it's just a starting point from a question standpoint. It's like coming from left field. That's because they don't start off with a heuristic, a model of what that looks like, so they don't have experience. So evidence-based practice should take the experienced practitioner and speed them through a diagnosis, not that they can't be wrong in what their first impression was. When it comes to treating the patient, the place experience comes into play is when there's no evidence.
Well, this is what's fascinating is because before 1993, it was all intuition-based medicine. So the seasoned doctor, you know, had the perspective based on history. Oh, this is what it looks like. This is what I've seen before. And this is how I treat with success. And that's how I train my interns is
Terry,
to really cut that
you?
Time in half, you know, and be able to identify based on their my experiences, what we see. And then you have the tests that you were talking about that you've taught in school that now, when we learned it, they're called different things. They're more, maybe the evidence has changed. So it is really now there's a different type of medicine that's beyond evidence-based, and we call it interpersonal medicine, and that basically caters to circumstances, capabilities, and preferences of the patient. So
But that's part of evidence-based practice. That starts with that's part of the three-legged stool. You know, it's a funny thing because like the you'll find that there's a bunch of people who don't want to call it evidence-based practice. They want to call it evidence-influenced. And a rose by any other name is still a rose. And if you like to use different words, so you don't have to use the word you don't like, you know, because that's the same thing Keith was saying to me. It's just a game. That's a semantic game.
Yeah.
Because evidence-based practice is still individualized to the patient. It's still patients' wishes and desires and values get incorporated in there. Doctor's expertise, it has an important part of it. But the idea is, you know, I once had some chiropractor calls me up and he says, "Oh, you're the evidence-based chiropractor guy. You're the most hated man in the state of Connecticut." I said, "Well, that's good. I mean, most hated, most loved. I don't care. You know, it's the most. That's good by me." And I said, "Why?" And I gave him an example and I said, "Here, I'm going to give you a scenario. If I have a patient and I have two different treatments and one treatment will help the patient get better in three visits and the other is going to take 25, seems to me that most patients would like to get better in three." And he says, "Oh, you're in the pocket of the insurance company." I said, "I never set the cost. Those three visits could cost 10 times what the 20 did." I said, "I'm in the patient's pocket. That's who I care about. I want to get the patient better, faster, easier. That's what matters to me."
Well, let me backtrack for just a moment. So,
sure.
The pandemic has really created an environment where evidence or science or the research has been under such scrutiny and the truth has been slanted. And then you got two ends of the spectrum arguing and they're, you know, whether they're epidemiologists or, you know, or chiropractors, there's completely different perspectives on it. How do you feel about where evidence-based perspectives are now? Because the public isn't trusting
it hasn't changed at all. The public isn't trusting us because a bunch of politicians started saying things that are BS. And then you got people, and then you also got people who, you know, like one example is this physician. Her name is, I think, Tenpenny.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, she's a lunatic. Her license was just taken away. There's nothing that she says that I have faith in. I know she is someone who, when she looks at the evidence, she doesn't look at the evidence. That what she does is, you know, it's, you can be honest. And if you want someone who's disagreed with some of the approaches to the pandemic, let's take someone who actually understands science, because a lot of these people who say, "I did research, I look for stuff," these people don't understand the nature of scientific research. They don't understand the nature of cause and effect. They don't understand epidemiology. And And if you don't understand these things, then you can get to sound to other people who don't understand it like you're brilliant when you're entirely full of crap. I mean, it's much like it. I don't know if you've heard of this group called Science-Based Medicine. Mm. Do you know them?
Heard of them.
So what do you know about them?
Not enough. Go ahead. What are you going to say?
Okay. Well, you don't want to know anything about it, actually. But science-based medicine is this rabidly anti, they call it quackery, group. And they have whole web pages about chiropractic care and how, you know, it's BS and everything like that. And first of all, I call these people science dilettantes because they use science to try and support their argument, but they don't actually know science well enough to do so because they've never done science. Science is not something, you know, science is a process by which we acquire better and better knowledge about what is truth. Science doesn't tell us the truth. It leads us towards the truth. Mm-hmm. And good science is self-correcting and it changes progressively as we go along. Like I'm going to tell you that I know, because I know when you went to TCC, that you were taught the energetics of the sliding element theory 180 degrees out of sync with how the best evidence is today. Was that because, Dr. Slack, who taught it to you? Jim Slack, who taught it to you, right? How's that for a memory? I remember
that was good.
Was it because Slack was an idiot? No, he was not. It's exactly what it said in Guyton's Physiology. But the nature of science is that science grows by destroying past knowledge. That's the nature of science.
But then
you have to deal with what is the best evidence today. Not the best evidence last week and not the best evidence next month.
But with all this, you know, the way science has become polluted, the things that are published by researchers that are funded by the pharmaceutical companies that cause, you know, that whole thing. And then yet there's also research that is funded by the, you know, chiropractic, companies that support chiropractic. And so there's the nocebo and the placebo of it and all that. So, I mean, it throws science into a frenzy as to what you believe.
No, it doesn't.
It doesn't.
It doesn't. What it throws, I think the Brits use the term the spanner in the gears, you know, the monkey wrench in the gears. What throws it in is people's lack of understanding of science. So go back to the science-based medicine people. They say, of course, that cervical manipulation causes stroke. Mm-hmm. Well, that's because A, they don't understand epidemiology. And epidemiology, like statistics and probability, is not something that is, I'm going to say, natural thinking. It's not consistent with how you look at the world. You have to learn it. They don't understand biomechanics. So they ignore that. American Heart Association published a paper about stroke and cervical manipulation. You may not know, because it's not well known, that I was one of two chiropractors who was part of the group to write it. And they drew conclusions that were not consistent with the actual literature. And so I couldn't get them to, you know, understand the reality. So I quit. Mm. And if you look in the paper, it'll say there was a chiropractor involved who quit and, you know, didn't want their name used. Mm. And they make it almost makes it sound as if I agreed, but I didn't want everybody to know that I agreed. Mm. No, I mean, it was. You know, like, for example, the section on biomechanics of arterial injury was written by a neurologist. I was on the team that wrote the part, but she wrote the original draft. She didn't know biomechanics. You know, my research at first at UB was all biomechanical about things. So, you know, I read what she wrote. It was like, oh, my God, she's got the biomechanics. She learned it to write the damn paper. And so in the part we're writing, she's got this stuff that, you know, says that when we look at stresses and strains, and so stress is force per unit area, strain is percent change in length, and they say to her, stop using chiropractic jargon. It's like, chiropractic jargon, this is basic physics. This is basic material science. This is basic biomechanics. And they couldn't understand that the amount of stretch on the artery that happens during the course of manipulation is about 1/7 of what it takes to actually injure the artery.
Beautiful. That is great.
Right? But that's because they didn't know enough either. Well, that's the people who say the stuff about the vaccines. It's because they don't know enough about the vaccines. And it's, you know, I think like chiropractors who are relatively, and I can actually tell you because we surveyed the profession, we did a stratified by state random survey of all licensees in the United States, 10% of them. And I can tell you that approximately 40% of them think that vaccines are not, you know, like the question was something, you know, like overall, do vaccines provide, you know, benefit? And 40% said no. You know, that's what I thought when I left chiropractic college until I started learning things. And you're going to wonder, you know, how do these two things come together? The psychology of people who've had strokes that they think is caused by manipulation is identical to the psychology of people who think they or their kids were harmed by vaccines. It's they have some negative outcome, whether it was caused by this or not, and they want to blame someone.
Right. Right. So I have a question for you.
Yep.
And that is, yep. Do you feel that every person on the planet should get a cervical manipulation?
No.
Okay.
I don't think everyone on the planet should get an adjustment at all.
Do you believe that every person on the planet should be vaccinated?
No.
Okay. That's all. I rest my case.
I mean, I think the ubiquitous application of any therapeutic intervention without looking at the circumstances of the individual is stupidity.
Absolutely. I agree. And that was accidentally written in your New York Times by a medical doctor during the pandemic. And I was surprised it got in there. And that is simply that what happened to the examination process to qualify if a patient should get a vaccine when they're just arbitrarily injecting everyone. So my thought was, why doesn't everybody get cervical manipulation?
Yeah, but the thing is, so if we want to deal with it that way and be objectively scientific about it, first of all, we know that the vaccines have a remarkably good safety record. And we also know that if we're dealing with the vaccines for COVID-19, they have a remarkable record of effectiveness. We do not know that for cervical manipulation. And we do not know that cervical manipulation is therapeutically beneficial for individuals who do not have, I'm going to say, neck pain headache. We don't know that, you know, like the straight chiropractors believe that we're going to, like, you know, get innate intelligence to become innine intelligence.
Oh, we I never heard that.
You know where I got that from? I got that from an FCA meeting because there was like a company selling clothing and yeah. they had hats that said N8.
Oh gosh.
So I said, okay, let's have N9. Why not? Hey, let's do like Spinal Tap. Let's do N11.
Yeah. For those listening, we're referring to a play on words as innate, INNATE, innate intelligence. And so Dr. Pearl thought of N9. Take it one step.
In 11. Did you see Spinal Tap? You know, the amplifiers go up to 11. So, you know, let's do in 11. But, you know, the thing is that we just don't have the evidence that every human being needs to be adjusted.
Steve, do we have
the evidence that the vaccine's effective? I mean, obviously there's certain people that have certain conditions that say they shouldn't get vaccinated, but as a general rule, the vast majority of people should have. I mean, in your state of Florida, you know, the death rate was higher than it was in other states because of the attempt to say vaccines are bad and we don't want everybody to be vaccinated. I mean, we know this. We also know there's very good evidence that if you're a Republican, you're more likely to have died after the vaccine came about than beforehand. And there's good epidemiological evidence. Before the vaccines, the likelihood of dying, whether you were a Republican or Democrat, was identical. Once the vaccines rolled out, if you were a Republican, you're more likely to die because they stopped getting the vaccines. And the interesting part about it is that the overall between Democrats and Republicans, the overall, I'm going to say, anti-vaccination attitude between both groups was substantively identical. That the far left didn't like vaccines before COVID. The far right didn't like vaccines before COVID. But what happened was the Republicans kept saying, it's just the flu. It's just the flu. It's no big deal. And if it's the flu, do you need vaccines? And so the relative rate of vaccination between counties that were more Republican than more Democrat was much lower penetration of vaccines in the Republican counties, and the death rates were up, and they show it.
I saw the statistics, and unfortunately, we've inherited a lot of your population in both California and New York because of your belief systems, and our economy and our education has is much further along than both of your states. Just an FYI. So the results are our governor had a different perspective and had provided a opportunity for us to do, you know, I mean, he recognized chiropractors as essential services. So we were able to stay in practice, and I did, and it was great. But, yeah, but you know I want to get back. Let me ask you,
I get that it's, you know, it's a business and it was better for your business. And so, you know, if you like him because he was better for your business, I get it. But from a, a health policy standpoint, the data are very clear. He was not good for the state of Florida.
Oh, I don't, okay. That's what everybody else says, but yet, you know.
I know. You know what?
New York,
people
New
lie
York
with statistics.
Listen, bottom line is there's a mass of people that moved out of your states to come here because we're thriving now, even in education and
in education, because we of course know how slavery was good for slaves. That's Florida education. Give me a break. You know, that's like I heard someone recently saying, yeah. So here's DeSantis's view. Slavery was good for slaves. And the next thing he's going to tell us is that the Holocaust was good for us Jews, too. Right. You know, come on.
OK. And your governor's perfect. All right. So let me ask you.
The perfect politician doesn't exist.
Let me get back to it, especially in California. But that's another.
I agree on that one.
I know you do. Is there a significant amount of research on spinal manipulation, on spinal manual manipulation, and also done by osteopaths, even to quantify, you know, the effects of spine? I mean, I imagine you even lecture on things like that.
I'm taking time out of writing a textbook because I am writing the new edition of Chiropractic Technique by Peterson and Bergman. So I'm like well invested right now in the literature on this. So, I used to in class show this particular paper by the lead author was Assendelft. And if you saw the abstract and what appeared in media, is the abstract said there's no evidence to show that spinal manipulation is more effective than standard medical care. And most chiropractors looked at that and said, what's wrong with that guy? He's saying it's better, it's worse. And no, the actual conclusion of the paper as opposed to the abstract was there's no evidence to show that spinal manipulation is superior to standard medical care. And there's no evidence to show that standard medical care is superior to spinal manipulation. Truly effective interventions are not being found. That's 25 years ago. Can we say that spinal manipulation is a potentially therapeutically effective intervention for back pain, neck pain, headaches? The answer is definitely. Should it be a frontline treatment? Most guidelines running around the world are all saying that it's one of a set of options that is good as a frontline treatment. You know, I mean, some patients are going to say, and this is patient values. Some patients are going to say, I don't want to go see a chiropractor, you know, because the only chiropractor I ever heard of was these two guys, you know, Wayman and Barron. I don't want to see those guys. Not them. Pearl I'd like, but he's not in California or Florida. So forget that. I want to take, you know, NSAIDs. if you had equal outcomes for these things, then that's a reasonable thing. But actually, evidence is showing that NSAIDs are not so effective. Mm-hmm. So, you know, is it safe? Is effective? Yeah. Is it effective for everybody? Hell no. You know that yourself. You know, you get the patient, you get the patient you think this is going to be so easy and it's not. You get the patient you think I'm never going to be able to help them. And they're I call them the one hit wonders. You know, you give them one adjustment and boom, they're off and everything's good. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Well,
and then if your question is about the effects of manipulation, I mean, that's the thing that, you know, there's a lot of research on this about what does it actually do? And, you know, it's interesting that we look at and I've published a recent paper on this, is that we don't have good evidence that specificity matters. The studies where, you know, someone is told, like Mitch Haas does a study where they come in, somebody evaluates the cervical spine, says, this is where you should adjust. And then the patient is randomized to getting adjusted there or elsewhere. And the person who does the adjustment doesn't know what the original doctor said, and they get the same outcome.
Okay.
So
I have a question for you that I've been curious about. So there's a very popular podcaster out there that does not seem to believe in chiropractic. We won't mention who it is, but he is probably one of the most popular podcasts in the country.
I'm happy to say I've never listened to that person.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, he's had some good guests on, but the point is he does not believe or does not appear to believe in or think that chiropractic has any value to, and yet he practices other non-traditional approaches of healthcare. If you, Stephen, Dr. Pearl, in all your wisdom and knowledge base, were to educate him on chiropractic, what would you say?
I wouldn't.
After all that?
Well, you know, I say, and I don't know if this resonates with you, but like particularly when talking about stroke, is I say, you know, being a Jewish chiropractor, that being Jewish prepared me to be a chiropractor, because approximately, you know, let's say about 2-3% of the American populace is Jewish, and about 2-3% of all healthcare providers are Jewish. Are chiropractic-ish, you know, are chiropractors, and so, you know, as a minority. And we happen to be invisible minorities. I mean, I don't see a large Mogen David on you. I don't have one. So we're an invisible minority. You know, the Hasidim, they're another story. You know, they're very visible, you know, much like Asians or people of African descent are visible minorities. As an invisible minority, you go through the world and you can see how people talk about minorities and even how they talk about your minority if they don't know who you are. Mm-hmm. And, you know, what I learned is, there are three types of anti-Semites. One is ignorant people, and an ignorant person can be educated. The second one are, and this came from Spike Lee. Spike Lee said that racism is a disease. Some people are diseased, and diseased people, there's nothing you can do about them. And I said three. There's actually only two. Of the antis, they're either ignorant or they're diseased. And if they're ignorant, they can be educated. And if they're diseased, there's nothing you can do about them. He's diseased. It's not worth the effort. Because I know he's had access to knowing the information. Information's not going to change his thinking. You know, that's Dana Lawrence, who was teaching at, you know, was at National for years, then Palmer, now at Parker. Dana tells me he was at a debate the students held on vaccinations. And he walked into the room and he said, I got a question. For those of you who don't think vaccinations are safe and effective, is there any evidence I could give you that would change your thinking? Raise your hand if there is. And nobody raised their hand. And he said, well, then therefore there's no reason to debate. Because if the evidence won't change your thinking, why bother?
Interesting.
Now, if you said to me instead that there was someone who espoused, I'm going to say, a generally anti-chiropractic viewpoint of the world, and then said, well, okay, you know, tell me why I should see a chiropractor. That's a different question. And to them, I'd say, well, first of all, I'd say, you know, if they say to me, like, why do I believe in chiropractic? My answer would be, I don't believe in chiropractic. Like, chiropractic is not a religion. You know, you believe in things that you have no evidence for, right? You know, if you believe that the Torah is the law, you know, like, you know, like Orthodox Jews would get mad at me because I'm not a completely ignorant Jew. I understand a lot about it, my religion, and I don't yet do what it says. They get mad because they're saying, here, this is the word of God. How can you not do what the word of God says? Well, the answer is because I don't believe it's the word of God. I don't have that faith. So I don't have faith in chiropractic. I don't believe in chiropractic. But what I know is that there is compelling evidence that tells me that the care that we provide for mostly, I'm going to say SRD, spine-related disorders, and use Don Murphy's terminology, that the care we provide for SRDs, for people who are competent and up to date and use the evidence, is better care than they will find in most other places, except for other people who, you know, who are doing the same thing. Because could a physical therapist do as well? Could an osteopath or an MD do as well? The evidence is out there. They can do what's best for a patient. They can deal with the person's psychosocial issues. They can deal with motivating them. They can create good therapeutic alliance. They can, you know, get them to exercise. They get them to be more self-reliant. They can add mobilization or manipulation. They can get them to do these things. You know, if the person's got a disc problem, get them to do McKenzie exercises. They've got, you know, peripheral neuropathy, get them to do nerve flossing. They can do all those things also. But I think chiropractors, you know, some of them have got the big idea that they can do this, and others have the skill set that needs to be tweaked a little bit, and then they can do this much better.
Okay. So we talked about, gosh, I want to go into our rapid fire questions, but I got to ask this one thing and try to keep it brief. Sure. I know your wife's an attorney and she probably has some influence on your thought process. And I hope so, because I'm going to ask about, have you ever considered the fact that there is professional prejudice against chiropractic, but nobody's making a big deal about it? Because if I use the, you know, a slang to refer to a certain race or creed or religion, I'll get in trouble. But yet,
right,
medical doctors are telling us that we're quacks.
Well, you know, 1983, I'm at a cocktail party, and MD and I meet each other. He, you know, hi, I'm Dr. Jones, I'm a medical doctor. Hi, I'm Dr. Pearl, I'm a chiropractor. He drops my hand, spins on his heels 180 degrees, and walks away from me.
No.
But by 3 years later, I have an MD who's practicing with me. I've practiced with MDs. You know, I've been the medical director of events where the people I'm in charge of are MDs, and everybody's fine and good. So, you know, have I experienced the prejudice? Yeah, I have. And that's why I say they can either be educated because they're ignorant or they're diseased. But I also think, and I think here's another example of where being a Jew informs how I think of these things. You know, if you say the mass migration of Jews that came in the latter part of the 19th century, early part of the 20th century until the 1920 when the law was changed, they came in, and, you know, the second generation, you know, I want to go to Harvard, I want to go to Yale or something like that. And hey, we're only going to let, you know, a few lucky Jews in. And you know, we're not going to let you in our unions. We're not going to let you do this. And what they said was, cool, we'll create, you know, Hofstra, we'll create Brandeis, we'll create Yeshiva University. We will create our own. You know, the Irish, when they came to America, you know, they were horrible Catholics supposedly. And so, you know, they can't do anything. And what did they do? They created Notre Dame. You know, they created Boston College. They said, you don't like us? Good. We don't give a crap. We'll go on. And I think the problem becomes when you let people say bad things about you and A, you don't respond to it. You know, that's like the value of the Anti-Defamation League. And two is you let it affect you personally, psychologically. And yeah. So you have to say, you know what? That MD is diseased. Maybe he or she or they are the reason why some hospital won't hire me or some, you know, practice won't refer to me. okay, you know what? There's more fish in the sea. I'll go someplace else. There's nothing I can do about them because that person's diseased. And eventually the diseased one will go away and someone who's not diseased will appear. And I think, you know, the chiropractors in the VA are changing the world for chiropractic on a daily basis because 50% of all MDs in America do their training in a hospital, in a VA hospital, and they're seeing what's happening. You know, when we first went to Washington and I participated in the lobbying, we got, I believe it was 7 chiropractors got hired. There was one per VISN, the area regionalization within the VA. And now I think there's over 350. They went from starting with like 2 or 3 residencies to I think there's 7 or 8 residencies. You know, I have so many of my former students who are working in VA, you know, people who are working in DOD. They went kicking and screaming, not having us. But then what happened was they saw the evidence. You know, they've published the evidence that shows that people who go see chiropractors don't get on opioids. They've seen the evidence that these people get back to work faster. They have better military preparedness and they are back to work. And so the VA started hiring all these extra chiropractors because their internal data showed them that what we did provided value. And they also, like there's Anthony Lisi published this interesting, paper. It was a qualitative study where they interviewed MDs about their relationship with chiropractors. And they'd say, yeah, you know, before the chiropractor came to work for us in the VA, you know, like I thought chiropractors were a bunch of quacks, but that doctor is competent. They're a good diagnostician. They provide good care for everybody. I would trust them with my life.
Gosh, I love this. That is a perfect way to end. And you just made me think, you know, Dr. Jason Petrocco Napoli, right? You know who that is?
I think we're going to
get him on our show because he is very deeply involved in positioning chiropractors for in the VA. So thank you for that.
You should get Don Murphy on also. And I don't think you have had Don and the guys from Spine Care Partners because what they've been doing is there's a recent study by Jim Whedon from LA, who's now at LACC, Southern California University Health Sciences, where what they did is a chiropractor who has gone through the University of Pittsburgh's primary spine practitioner program that Don Murphy, Mike Schneider, and those guys set up at Pitt. This guy was at Dartmouth, and Dartmouth has a big program in health policy research, and they've shown that the patients who went to this PSP trained chiropractor, that they had a decreased likelihood of escalation of care. So escalation of care is, you know, whether they get drugs, whether they get surgery, whether they get advanced imaging, all those kinds of things. And so the chiropractor there was a cost saving and got patients back to work faster. It's a really nice study. I mean, there was an earlier one that Ian Paskowski did at the hospital in Providence, which, you know, that hospital, their spine care program is run by chiropractors. The assistant director is a former student of mine. They have like 4 of my former students working at that hospital in, did I say Providence? Plymouth, Mass, actually, not Providence.
That's great. Steve, we're going to close, but man, what a chock full of information. I appreciate that. I love that you've disseminated some research out to the audience and some perspectives that really created a little bit of a nice debate between us. And I always love you, Steve. And why don't you wish me a happy birthday anymore? Every year, January 21st, I would get a text message from you.
No, it's on Facebook. I swear, every single time. Go look on Facebook. You'll see I do it every time. How about the time I showed up at your office on your birthday?
That's right. I forgot about that. That's right. You're the best. I love you.
I said to the staff, don't tell him who's out here. Just tell him he has to come out to the front desk.
I forgot. That's right. That was great. Terry, anything you want to finish?
We're good. Hey, bud, thanks for it. It's been a joy listening to you guys go after it and have fun. And it's always a joy to see you, man.
It's great.
Likewise. You can disagree without being disagreeable, right?
Yeah, of course.
That's what conversations are all about. I love that. All right, brother. Have a good day, man.
Yeah.
Thanks, Steve.
Take care.
Thank you for listening to today's episode of the Crackin' Backs podcast.
We hope you enjoyed it. Make sure you follow us on Instagram at Crackin' Backs Podcast. Catch new episodes every Monday. See you next time.